Well, welcome, everybody, to the Cosmic Connection here at Brass Meeting Live from the launching pad here in Sedona, Arizona. And it's another really, today is actually a very beautiful day. I don't see as much chemtrail activity. It's kind of hazy, so yeah, they were doing something a little earlier this morning, but it's relatively clear. And it's just an incredibly interesting time that we're living. Now, there's going to be a very interesting topic I'm going to be discussing today, and also in a few minutes, welcoming back my returning guest, Andrew Bushargo, who is quite an expert on a number of topics. Somewhat a little bit about today's I'm going to talk about, but also about time travel technology and how it relates to today's topic. And I'm going to be talking about 9/11. Now, I have referred to this in a few shows in the past, but never actually did a whole show on it. But today, so you are open to a very interesting topic because there are, in my opinion, four dynamics that we're going to cover. And the first 5 or 10 minutes of the show, I'm going to share a little bit about my perceptions, and I'm going to open it up for Andrew to share what he knows from his knowledge based on some of the classified projects he was involved in, 9/11 and actually other events as well. Now, to me, 9/11 was a false flag. There was actually divine intervention involved, as I'll be discussing. This was a planetary wake-up call, in my opinion, and time travel technology documented it in the years before it actually occurred. All four of these dynamics, in my opinion, actually occurred on that day. Now, for those of you who are, coming to the show for the first time, and many of you will be hearing this in the archives, all our shows are archived after it being played live as today, I welcome you to this and also to check out some of the websites that I'm connected with. One of them is channelforthemasters.com, and that gives a little bit about my background, how I was originally trained, and the Edgar Cayce tradition of channeling. And eventually, after having physical contact with the human-appearing ETs, who are part of the Federation of Light, when I was taken aboard, physically taken aboard their Merkaba lightships and twice under life-threatening situations, they altered my DNA, RNA, ended up so I could do these transformational channel readings, which the higher beings put higher light encodements on the tape that are designed to activate DNA, RNA. And also prepareforthelandings.com. Now, I've just finished the updating of my second edition, Aurora Lights, in my book. That's within about a week. Hopefully should be available to download the new version as an e-book. And also in about a week or two, we should have, 2 or 3 weeks, we should have the paperback copies of this new edition. It's very exciting. I was updating a little bit, adding a few good information. So for those of you who have not had a chance to read it, and even those of you who read the first edition, I would highly recommend getting the second version, which I've changed, altered, improved a little bit, some new information that's more relevant to some of the challenges that we're facing and how it does prepare us. As the title, Prepare for the Landing, so ultimately this will be occurring. It's kind of, as I say, a sacred promise and cosmic done deal. It's just a matter of exactly when is the Federation of Light going to make their move. So that's all something exciting coming up in our lives, and this book does definitely prepare you for this future event, and there's also some great DVDs available also on that website. And then also vortextoursofsedona.com. I provide a service since having come to Sedona since 1980, having taken thousands of people on vortex tours, and then just recently, Bill, Alec, Aurora, and I finally found our cosmic realtors secured it for us, a great place which we call the launching pad, and this is where we're transmitting our show live today here in beautiful Sedona, Arizona. And I highly recommend people who get a chance to come in here, I take you on these vortex tours, which also not only activates DNA, RNA, but in a recent show I did, and as I've shared in other shows, there is, in my opinion, an old Stargate that's actually about to manifest back in physical reality. And there are other Stargates that are starting to pop up around the planet, and I know that the Black Ops, the Cabal, are very concerned about this, because they don't want we, the civilian level, to have access to these places, but it's going to happen. I know there's one in Gulf of Aden right now that's opened up, too. And there's actually, if you type in Stargate-Gulf of Aden, you'll actually see a photograph of it taken from many miles up of the swirl in the clouds, which is actually the Stargate. And, of course, they're not showing you the 300-some ship, military ships that surround that area to keep people out. So there's a lot going on. And, again, check out the website. Check out that NASA list of star people characteristics at channelforthemasters.com. And see how many of those characteristics that you have and how connected you are with this whole reality. Because it happens to be those connected with this are the ones that are drawn to the show and shows like this. And it is a wake-up call. There's a lot been going on. So as we turn our attention to today's topic of 9/11, I just want to share a few minutes And then I'm going to then invite Andrew Pashargo to come on the show and share a lot that he has that's very insightful. But I do want to share with everybody briefly that on the day that 9/11 happened, and Aurora Light and I were living in Florida at the time, and somebody called us up and said, turn on the TV. And I turned on the TV to see the second jet jam into the World Trade Building. And at that moment, Ashtar, who has communicated a lot with me through the years, and from the time he first appeared to me when I was 9 years old, and I was watching President Kennedy's nude conference on TV of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he pops in, and he's standing there theoretically, and he said to me, we're not going to allow nuclear war because it's against Federation policy. And specifically, he told me also how the world leaders would hold that over our heads as a fear tactic, and how, you know, they would actually fund terrorist groups to create certain situations, but the government used these kinds of things. So there was a lot of information he's communicated through the years. Well, on the day 9/11 happened, moments after I saw the jet jam into the building, his first words to me were, we just physically beamed up and numb most of the people out of the building. Now, that sounds bizarre, really, and why would they intervene, or even why would they allow it to happen? For those who are aware how divine interventions happen many times. And he also gave me a little history lesson, which I had forgotten how the Nazis actually gained control, you burning down the Reichstag building and using fear and manipulating humanity at that time, and how they took away humanity's rights and freedoms. And under a fascist regime, that was one of the incidents that helped to bring in the Nazi regime very strongly in Germany. So there were parallels. And there are some things, if you study historically, that have paralleled this event on 9/11. So it was very clearly told to me that day, this was a false flag that our own government, and connected with specifically what I call the cabal, the shadow government, was involved in, and how they were using this to manipulate us, to give up our rights and freedoms for so-called security. And he also told me that I would get photographic evidence in the future that would verify what he was telling me that day. Well, about 4 or 5 weeks later, on the Internet, it was actually, I forget which website it was on, but it showed up, an image. It was actually several frames of a disc-shaped object coming around behind the World Trade Building, and from the time that it first appeared in the first frame to the sixth one, it was like about a sixth of a second had occurred. And it was definitely a disc-shaped object. And when I asked Ashtar about it, he said, no, he said that was not the actual ship that beamed the people aboard, but that was a probe craft that they had in the area prior to it, and they were monitoring what was going on. And so it was very fascinating. And then since then, I've heard other stories from other people who also tuned into it, getting very similar information. And it was interesting because, in fact, one of the reports that came out through CNN, I heard this at a Laughlin UFO conference actually several years ago when I was sharing this. And Colonel Wendell Stevens, a friend of mine, was there. And there was somebody, a close friend of his also, who actually heard an incident. You know, the firemen and the police had to fill out special reports to define where they were at every moment, what they were involved in, if they fulfilled their responsibilities. Specific details had to be recorded. And I have tuned into the fact that that even though a majority of people were beamed up out of the building, that there were some of the people actually, because of the beam that had teamed people up, there was kind of that there was a scatter beam kind of that actually a few people showed up outside the building. Maybe their energy wasn't high enough to go aboard the craft, whatever. And they actually ended up outside, but who would believe their story? Well, there was a fireman who, one of the reports, this was initially reported over CNN. Now, if you were to call them up today, they would probably deny, like many other things that they officially recorded. But he stated that as he was going up to one of the upper levels, and as the building came down on top of him and the rest of the guys that he was with, all of a sudden, he found himself standing on the sidewalk outside, looking up at the World Trade Building as it was collapsing in on itself. He didn't know how he ended up there, but he stated in the report that CNN initially reported briefly about this. And this was a confirmation to me that there must have been a number of incidents like this, not just being beamed aboard the Merkaba lightship of the Federation of Light, but that there were people in certain situations finding themselves outside the building, and they figured, well, who can we tell this to? Who's going to believe us? So that was just an interesting confirmation. And then other things through the years of talking to numerous researchers who have studied it, like the engineers for 9/11 Truth, who have been talking about how there could not have come down, you know, airplane cannot make a building come down. And so there's a lot of interesting fallout in how this was definitely a wake-up call for a lot of people, and it backfired a little bit on the negative forces. And now I do believe that this obviously was something that was planned years ahead of time. And so just recently, when I had a chance to interview Andrew Bishargo, who is going to be my guest here in just a few moments, and also I interviewed him, last show I did with him was the show right before Easter on that Saturday, and how one of the most interesting things that he had shared earlier on, and we did a whole show on this, was the fact that he and his father were privy because of him being a part of Project Pegasus, and how he traveled through time in this top-secret project, how they also had the ability to videotape events past and future. So I want to welcome to my show today, Andrew. How are you doing today?
Excellent, Michael. Good to be with you again.
Yes, well, glad to have you back. You always have such fascinating information from your very detailed, scientific, high-tech understanding from the technology that's allowed not only you to travel through time and videotape, but to videotape these past events as well as future events. And I did want to get more into that today, because not only was 9/11, you say, a videotape, but other events as well, and we can talk a few about some of that as well. So just for those who are not familiar with you, Andrew, you might just going to give a brief nutshell background, and those can go into some of my PAC shows and hear some about your experiences. But just for the audience, for the new people, just give a little bit of background, if you wouldn't mind, too, about some of how you got involved in Project Pegasus and how that led you up to other things.
Right. Well, I'm a lawyer here in Washington State, and I'm currently maintaining a truth campaign in two areas, really in relation to my Mars findings, my analysis of NASA's photographs from Mars, and that of my colleagues at the Mars Anomaly Research Society, which is an organization I founded several years ago, shows that Mars is an inhabited planet. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that humanity take note of that and do the right thing in regard to Mars. In a more personal way, the second part of my truth campaign is focused on my experiences in DARPA's Project Pegasus in the late 60s and early 1970s. Project Pegasus was a classified defense-related research and development program. It really existed. I'm not talking about something that is from the realm of science fiction or metaphysical thinking. It was an actual historical program. It was essentially the U.S. time-space program at the time of its emergence. It was a program that was working primarily with two technologies, teleportation, which had emerged from the papers of Nikola Tesla during World War II, and chronovision, which was another quantum access technology that emerged in the 1940s as a result of an accidental discovery that was made by two Vatican musicologists named Ernetti and Gemelli, who later partnered with the Italian physicist Enrico Fermi, in not sending somebody to a past or future time via teleportation, as Tesla has allowed us to do, but to capture remote holographic images of a past or future event. And by 1970, the U.S. Defense Department had wrapped these two technologies essentially into an intelligence program. The emphasis by the time that I found myself in the program, beginning in the fall of 1969, as a third grader, as one of the child participants that they were introducing time travel to and training us to later serve in a cadre of adult chrononauts as the project emerged, was not so much focusing on the technologies as it was the application of the technologies to gather intelligence. Project Pegasus was a mapping exercise. In fact, the first location that I was taken to participate in the Chronovisor probe, which was a probe to a Civil War battle as it was taking place, was at the General Manufacturing Company facility in Convent Station, New Jersey, which was the old map-making subsidiary of Standard Oil, which during World War II had produced the maps for the Allies, the maps of England and the coast of France and Europe and so forth, to prosecute the war against Hitler's Germany. And so the significance of my research is that not only that, you know, and into my experiences in Project Pegasus, is not only that time travel emerged in the U.S. defense technical community and had a number of advanced quantum access technologies by 1970, but had already begun to actively gather intelligence with those technologies. And I've been investigating my experiences in a concentrated and focused way since around the year 2000. And hence, when the 9/11 event occurred, I realized I was in possession of information that ultimately would not determine what happened on 9/11, but which would provide insights into the question of what the U.S. government knew at the time that the 9/11 attacks occurred, whoever perpetrated them.
Well, I went before we, I just wanted to, without going too far off this, but for those who would like to, is, I wanted to know, now I have it, Bill Alec hasn't gotten it up in the archives from the earlier show, but there's an actual photograph of you taken in 1863 that you obtained from the archives that you feel that is actually of you when you were sent. But I just wanted to mention this for people who actually want to see a photo from an archive.
Yeah, probably the most astonishing thing that happened to me when I was a child and was actively time traveling for Project Pegasus was that I was sent to the Gettysburg address site in an effort to allow me to see President Lincoln give his famous Gettysburg address on November 19th, 1863. And that was achieved via a plasma confinement chamber under the direction of Dr. Sterling Colgate, who at that time was the head of the physics department. He would later become the president of New Mexico Tech. And I was basically inserted into that event, and I ended up being photographed there. So one of the interesting footnotes to my experiences in Pegasus is that the very picture that for many years was the sole known photograph depicting Lincoln at Gettysburg on the day he gave his address there is the first photograph to reveal a time traveler from the future. And I was the child standing in the center left foreground of that photograph. And when that photograph was published in the early 1970s in a leading news magazine, I believe it was Life magazine, reprising a publication of that image from the early 1950s, you know, going back 20 years of what had been in Life, I took that photograph to my father, who was one of the project engineers on Project Pegasus, and I said, "Dad, look, when you sent me to Gettysburg, I got photographed there." And he said, "Yep. Just don't talk about it." So I did confirm the fact that I am the child in that famous image from Gettysburg, and you could actually see we talked about this when I appeared on your show, and we talked about the Gettysburg jump, which was that in the photograph you can see I'm wearing the oversized men's shoes and other clothing that was provided to me by a Gettysburg cobbler when I stumbled into town without barefoot and without a jacket on, because some of my clothing had been wrenched off in the wormholing using that form of quantum access that allowed them to send me temporarily to Gettysburg.
What I wanted to mention something here that I mentioned in past shows. When I was much, you know, about 20 years, 25 years ago, when Aurora and I actually had connected with an undercover agent, one of many, and they had told us that both the United States and the Soviets, and there was certain technologies, he was talking about time travel technologies, and he said that agents actually were sent around to old archives to attempt to take out photos that might say during the Civil War that somebody showed up that in the photo that shouldn't be dressed like they were. And I asked her, I said to me, well, they didn't get all of them, inferring that they're in the future, said I would come across something that would verify this. And I've forgotten, sometimes they'll tell me stuff and I'll forget all about it. So when I heard your story and saw the photo, he was telling me, well, this is actually one of the things that was referred to. Even though you were dressed in that outfit of that time, it's still significant that this whole story has come out to verify that that's kind of a reference link to somebody who did, like yourself, travel back then. But go on, it's very fascinating.
Well, I don't discount that. In fact, I think I'd affirm what you're saying, because the very project I was part of was already retrieving, it was sending adult travelers via teleportation to the future. In fact, when I was a child serving on the project, they had retrieved my books from the future. And on several occasions, my dad brought a black sort of satchel from one of these secret archives to the lunch or dinner table and removed a book that I would write or edit in the future. and the book was passed around among some of his close friends in Albuquerque and the project people. And I'm amazed at the way in which they allowed some of their friends who weren't officially part of the project to see some of the data.
What book was that?
There was a number. They had my book, the memoir that I'm currently writing about my experiences in Project Pegasus. They had several of the books that I edited of Fernandez and Dermata's trilogy about the Fatima incident. And they also had Alfred Lambermont Weber's book, Exopolitics, which I edited for Alfred. And those books were literally being passed around and discussed when I was 8, 9, 10 years old on the project, and yet I wouldn't write or edit them for 40 years into the future. So I can confirm that the U.S. intelligence community was sending intelligence agents, that is to say adult intelligence agents, to past and future events by 1970, and undoubtedly in the same way that I got accidentally photographed there in Gettysburg as a child, I'm sure that some of our personnel were photographed in non-local locations in the time-space continuum.
That's fascinating. So to get back toward a little more toward the topic of 9/11, which is what we can go into other things too, but so how did this, how did you become aware in relation to things back whenever it was that there was information about 9/11 before it occurred?
Right. During those years, at the corner of Bullock Avenue and La Jolla Place in the small town of Socorro, New Mexico, there was a C-shaped building. I know that building was there because I visited it when I was a child on Project Pegasus several times with my father. And, in fact, during my September 2004 trip, fact-finding trip to New Mexico, I met with a number of individuals working in the research library at New Mexico Tech, which is immediately adjacent to that street corner. And they all confirmed what Aerojet denied before I left on that trip. I contacted Aerojet Corporation and said, look, I'm investigating my childhood involvement in a classified defense project. Is it not the case that you had a C-shaped building at the corner of Bullock Avenue and La Jolla Place in the early 1970s? In fact, it had a black macadam parking lot in the front that accommodated about 10 cars. You had a black granite-styled sign in the front with the words Aerojet Corporation in silver lettering. There was sort of a xeriscaped, you know, distinctively New Mexican courtyard in the interior of the C, you know, the concave of the front of the building there as a C-shaped building. And I was describing how I remember walking in. There was a security desk there. The left side of the building was a classified location, so there were bars like you would have in a prison that the guard had to open and allow you access to the left side of the building. And before I left in September 2004 on that fact-finding trip, they denied to me that they had a corporate presence in Socorro prior to 1985. Well, in fact, when I went there and spoke with Joy Thompson, who was then the research director for the New Mexico Tech Research Library, and her colleagues, many of whom had either grown up in Socorro or in any number of these other small towns in New Mexico, they all confirmed that I must have been there as a child because I was describing what was then there on that, that northeastern corner of the New Mexico Tech campus with great specificity. We went into the archives there, and we found that during those years, that Aerojet Corporation facility was being misidentified on the official New Mexico campus maps. In other words, I've retrieved documentary evidence showing that even though people who lived or grew up there knew that it was an Aerojet Corporation facility, and remember the sign that identified it as such, on the campus maps it was being identified as either Gibbons Hall, a student union of New Mexico Tech, or the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, which is about a mile west of that location, and is still there. So I knew that there was a cover-up of that building. Now, why would there have been an historical cover-up of that Aerojet Corporation facility ever having been on that street corner in the quiet town of Socorro, New Mexico? Well, the reason is that it was the location where Project Pegasus was processing images from the future. Now, I don't know the particular form of quantum access that captured the images that were being processed there. In all likelihood, they were the images that were being placed, the sort of summaries of intervening events between 1970 and 2045 that were being prepared in sort of historical summaries by the project historians for Project Pegasus who were living in 2045 and writing sort of Wikipedia or Time magazine sort of summaries of all of the major intervening events, and including still photographs and film loops in those microfilmed archives, and then personnel from Project Pegasus. I was involved in this myself. We were teleporting forward in time and retrieving those microfilmed summaries and bringing them back. And so I think what must have happened is some of them must have been damaged by the radiation effects within the Vortal tunnels that were propagated by the teleporters, because it was at that Aerojet Corporation facility, literally a defense contractor location, that technicians who were aligned with the physics department under Dr. Colby at New Mexico Tech were processing those images. So one day when my father and I were in New Mexico, the summer of 1971, I'm going to describe in my book how by using teleportation to have us teleport from New Jersey, spend days and weeks and months there, and then teleport back not just to New Jersey, but to New Jersey on the day we left, they essentially shoehorned four extra summers into my childhood, basically an extra summer of 1970, 71, summer of 73, pre-experienced by jumping from the fall of 1971, and then a pre-experience of a first summer of 1972. And after each of those summers, we went back to the day we left, so we then, like in the case of, let's say, the summer of 1972, we then had an entirely different summer back in New Jersey. So it was during one of these sort of quantum interludes in New Mexico where my dad and I were, in a sense, outside of ordinary time. We were on a beta timeline from the one that we had been living in New Jersey with our other family members and that we would return to after that particular summer. So in the summer of 1971, we were having lunch at the La Hacienda restaurant in Old Town Albuquerque. And I'm sure that any of your listeners who have been to Old Town Albuquerque know that then and even now, the La Hacienda and La Placita restaurants are two of the most famous Mexican restaurants in all of New Mexico. And because of that fact, and the fact that my father had a longstanding friendship with Mary Constance Chavez, Connie Chavez was the cashier at the La Hacienda restaurant and later worked at La Placita, that was sort of like the home away from home for those of us who were poor, you know, wayfaring time travelers who spent a lot of downtime in New Mexico. So whenever there was nothing to do on the project, you know, we might drive over and just even hang out with Connie at the La Hacienda. So we had just been finishing up lunch, and my dad received a call. Connie called him to the restaurant phone and said, "Ray, this is for you." And my dad listened intently and said, "Come on, Andy, we're going down to Socorro." And we hopped in his car, and we screamed down I-25, I think at about 90 miles per hour, because Socorro is 90 miles south of Albuquerque, and we got there in about an hour. And we parked in the macadam blacktop in front of the C-shaped Aerojet Corporation facility. I'm still looking, by the way, for historical photographs. I'm pretty confident that I'll find them of that facility because I've confirmed, as I said, that it existed. And we parked the car. We hurriedly walked in. My dad said to the security guard, "My son's coming with me," you know, after showing his security badge. And we were allowed past the iron bars, steel bars, to the classified left side of that C-shaped building. And in the hallway there, one of the technicians, these would be one of the young physics graduate students under Dr. Colgate that were sort of kind of spending some of their graduate physics education working in this classified project there. I don't know if they were employed by the Defense Department or Aerojet Corporation or just were attending New Mexico Tech, but they were sort of spending some of their time working in that time lab or that photoanalytic operation there that was processing images from the future. And one of them, just like you know, Clint Howard in a disaster movie, you know, in Armageddon, sort of bounds up to us in the hallway all excitedly and says to my father, Ray, you're not going to believe it. We've got it. We've got images of the domestic Pearl Harbor event." And my dad goes, incredible, or something like that. And we go into a room there that had about 20 or 25 monitors. I mean, it was literally choked with television-like equipment. And these two young technicians popped a kind of rudimentary videotape unit, like a Betamax unit, into a VCR-type device. And this was before the advent of these technologies in the civilian sector. And as I described this experience to Vin DeBona, who's the executive producer of Entertainment Tonight, he found it interesting that what I then described was essentially a digital technology that he knew as a result of his career in television did not yet exist in professional television production. Because what we then saw was an image that pixelated into view, which is to say that there was a set of squares or pixels in the videotape that formed on the tape and then kind of became a consistent image. And computer processed pixelized digital images had not yet developed in mainstream television. But it was clearly in the possession of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is in the nature of what DARPA has been doing, is developing technologies that are then not introduced in the civilian sector for decades. And in the case of these quantum access technologies, we were told they might not be introduced for literally 200 years into the human future. So after the videotape was popped into the device, what we quickly saw when the image pixelated, so that it then filled up the whole screen for about 20 seconds of this television monitor, was a close-up image of one of the planes crashing into one of the twin towers and exploding in a brilliant orange fireball. And the two young graduate students who were in possession of these images were so transfixed by it that they just kept on playing it over and over again. And then when one of the planes would hit the top of the building, they would go, bam, now look at that. Because what had been going on inside Project Pegasus is that intelligence reports were being promulgated that were briefing different project principals on things we knew that the future would hold or things we had discovered about the past that would strain credulity or utterly fascinate you. But they didn't have a complete data. For example, there was a discussion of the advent of the Internet one day at one of the lunches there in Old Town Albuquerque. And somebody was trying to explain to my father what the Internet was. That it was, you sort of sat at an electronic typewriter and looked at a TV screen-like device, and with that you could communicate with anybody anywhere in the world. And my dad got up from the table and said, I don't know, I'm still bothered by this .com thing. Maybe it means the commies have taken over by that. So I really have to put it sort of in the social context of it is these project engineers and federal science administrators, individuals like Donald Rumsfeld, who was the defense attaché to Project Pegasus, who my father and I had extensive social interaction with when we were attached to Project Pegasus, and who would go on and become the defense secretary on September 11th of 2001, they didn't have omniscience. They didn't have complete grasp of what the future held. They had a set of things people had seen when they were time traveling there. Maybe they sent somebody and they saw what was on a newspaper in a newspaper rack, or they grabbed a book of somebody, or we retrieved data scrolls of the summaries. But then when we brought the data scrolls, you know, the microfilm back, a lot of it was damaged, so they only got bits and pieces of the future. So the individuals like my father who were trying to get a grasp of what the future held, so they could understand it and report it to the CIA, because DARPA's Project Pegasus, in an immediate sort of intelligence community sense, had reporting requirements to the CIA so that what we knew about the past and future that could be gathered non-locally through teleportation, through chronovision, could be passed along to the president and our military leaders and distributed throughout the intelligence community itself, at least on a need-to-know basis. So the domestic Pearl Harbor that for which the term 911 was attached was something that was openly discussed in front of me when my father and the other project principals would sort of commiserate around lunch or sort of talk shop about what they knew. But they in no way either were planning the event or knew every last ramification of it. For example, that a very robust sort of opposition movement in terms of interpreting the event would emerge in the United States that would purport that the event was actually, as you say, a Reichstag fire that was perpetrated by the government itself to achieve a variety of purposes, certainly regimenting us in a police state via passage of the Patriot Act, which is one of the alleged goals of what may have been an inside job, as Jim Mars has described. So the significance of my data, this 20 minutes of experience on Project Pegasus that related to 9/11, is that this particular defense project, which was gathering millions of feet of data and filming it of past and future events. Let me go into that. I was taken to a national security watch post that was engaged in filming chronovisor obtained images from the past. And it was at that location in Flemington, New Jersey, where I was shown an 8-inch circular screen in which the actual signing of the U.S. Constitution was going on. In other words, the technician literally pointed to George Washington on the dais and then to Benjamin Franklin. And while I couldn't make out General Washington very well, actually at that point he would be President Washington a year later, but while I couldn't make out George Washington as he appeared on September 17th of 1789 in Constitution Hall, I could clearly see Ben Franklin as he existed in life. And I remember at that facility, the technicians in their white lab coats were filming canister after canister of 16-millimeter film footage of what they were holographically recovering of past events. So what I can say is that in this defense project, which was doing so much data retrieval of past and future events, they had footage of 9/11. They openly talked about the domestic Pearl Harbor that was coming. They knew it was a mega event in U.S. and world history. They believed the conventional explanation, because when my father explained one time what happened on that dreadful day, he essentially gave the conventional explanation to one of his colleagues, that Middle Eastern terrorists would hijack commercial airliners, crash them into the Twin Towers, which were just still being constructed in Manhattan, that the towers would fall down like a ton of bricks, as my dad said in his colloquial rural Pennsylvania kind of way. And then he was asked, well, what happens then, Ray? And he said, well, the country gets up on its feet, brushes itself off, and then goes on again like nothing abnormal happened. So they had basically an understanding of the conventional story of the event. And that strengthens my suspicion that they simply retrieved enough about 9/11 from the data scrolls we were recovering from the future to essentially get the Time magazine version, the sort of the sanitized conventional version of that event, as it would have been written about by government historians in 2045, so that it could be sent back to the early 1970s and understood by individuals working on this intelligence project, like my father, like Donald Rumsfeld, like some of the Manhattan Project physicists that were involved. And so that is what I can contribute to the 9/11 literature. I'm not saying that I know that 9/11 was an inside job. I don't know that. It may have been. I found Jim Marr's two books, The Inside Job and The Terror Conspiracy, very convincing. They're both full of substantial evidence that suggests that 9/11 may very well have been an inside job, a Reichstag fire, as it were.
I just want to say that, I understand how, you know, a time traveler, if they're seeing the conventional accepted view through newspapers, but is it possible,
exactly,
which you have no knowledge of at this point, that they also stumbled upon meetings going on that they infiltrated, that of those who did participate in the inside job, but that has not been provided to you yet? Is that possible there was a parallel, that they found data that could...
Yeah, Michael, you know, it really is, and actually, let me kind of articulate this. My dad was a great guy. I mean, he was definitely a white hat, okay? He wore a white hat.
Right.
He was a great man, a great father, a devout Roman Catholic. He was just a highly moral human being.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I think of your question, and I think back about the way he was handling questions about 9/11, when they would come up, they came up maybe three or four times at lunch, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Really did, almost in a mannered way, give the conventional explanation, and also do so while he was sort of looking away, like maybe he was looking up at a TV headset behind the counter, you know, behind the lunch counter at a baseball game or something. So he was kind of settling it when this discussion of 9/11 came up. So is it possible that some of the moral, well-intended people on the project were actually aware of elements of the cabal inside Project Pegasus that were actively planning it? Yes, that's entirely possible. And let me actually point to a very intriguing data point from the 9/11 investigation that still needs to be investigated, I think, as thoroughly as my claim that Project Pegasus had prior data regarding 9/11. Mm-hmm. And that's the statement by Senator Bob Kerrey of Nebraska, former Senator Bob Kerrey of Nebraska, who was the co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, who was asked about whether the 9/11 report was really a valid exercise. And he's on the record. You can find it on YouTube as stating to just a private citizen 9/11 researcher who approaches him after he gave a talk that, no, I don't believe the report was adequate, and I don't think we'll ever know exactly what happened on 9/11 because this was, after all, a 30-year conspiracy. Now, I can confirm that DARPA's Project Pegasus recovered remote images of the 9/11 event 30 years before it happened. And I really think that it's incumbent on President Obama to reconvene a new 9/11 commission and investigate claims like mine, but also statements made by really central individuals to this whole event in our history, like the estimable Senator Bob Kerrey of Nebraska, one of really our most intelligent and, I think, principled public servants. Was he just talking about the advent of Middle Eastern terrorism in the early 70s, that is to say, the Black September movement and the years when, for example, hijackings of commercial airliners began? Or was he talking about something far more sinister, which would have been the planning for this event in our the inner reaches of our government, our defense community and intelligence community, back in the early 1970s? To the extent that Secretary Rumsfeld was the defense attaché to Project Pegasus and was in President Bush's cabinet on the day of this horrendous attack on our country, I really think we have to explore whether the Bush administration was at a minimum in possession of information about the event or planned the event. There are multiple data points establishing that on September 10th, for example, they were taking actions with prior knowledge of the event. Now, in the law of criminal defense, conventionally, under the criminal law that's evolved, prior knowledge of a felony is deemed to create a rebuttable presumption that you either perpetrated the event, were an accomplice to the event, or at a minimum, didn't exercise your civic duty to contact law enforcement about a criminal event that you knew was being planned and would be carried out, which in some states has made individuals an accomplice to an event before the fact. Usually not, but nonetheless, it's viewed as a malum in se offense, an act that's inherently wrongful. And yet, there's kind of a complication here with the advent of time travel, because quantum access allows entirely innocent people to have prior knowledge of future crimes. And so that's why I've tread so cautiously in revealing my information. I made a conscious decision to hold my data and allow the dust to settle regarding 9/11, allow the commission to complete its work and publish its report, to allow the 9/11 Research Committee to be disbanded and the Research Commission to be disbanded, and to allow the 9/11 research community to float all of the possible explanations and conspiracy theories that need to be advanced to explore what really happened on that day. Because I was concerned, in one way, that 9/11 was so traumatic, such a large magnitude event, that this issue would color everything I had to share about Project Pegasus. And at the same time, the strange nature of this time travel linked data might contaminate our understanding of 9/11. And so I'm really making a limited point here, which is that it had to be relevant somehow because the Defense Department was in possession at a minimum of these moving images of the event. And because you have this continuity of personnel involving Secretary Rumsfeld, I really think that we need to to have a new 9/11 commission and explore what exactly the Bush administration knew and did on that day and on the previous day. We know, for example, that Condoleezza Rice, who was then the National Security Advisor for our country, informed former Mayor Willie Brown of San Francisco not to fly on 9/11. We know that there was a FEMA response team in downtown Manhattan on September 10th. We know that President Bush spoke of having seen the first plane hit the first tower at a time when such footage was not available,
right,
and only Chronovision recovered images sent to his limousine, for example, when he was at that elementary school in Florida, would have enabled him to do so. We know that in the case of Secretary Rumsfeld, that his desk was moved to the opposite side of the Pentagon, away from the area of the Pentagon where the missile struck the Pentagon on September 11th of 2001. So I've been troubled by the fact that I've been in possession of this information about 9/11. I haven't been trying to manipulate it in any way. I've simply been holding it so that when I release it, it can be put in context and it won't overwhelm or in any way distort the proper investigation of what was a heinous crime.
Yeah, I think this is the whole thing, that, you know, truth has to come out. I think that you've been doing the best you can to get in a position that when this is going to come out more and more, and people like yourself are going to help contribute to revealing and to the whole reality of what actually happened. Beyond all the theories, there definitely seems to be a massive amount of evidence on many, many levels that documents that some kind of, quote, conspiracy cover-up, thing occurred, and the fact that they were able to see it years ahead of time, well, where does the responsibility lie? We don't want to manipulate time, yet, to me, time travel technology could be used to this is a potential future. This is the timeline we view. But is it not all possible to alter future disasters if people are aware of it at a time, kind of like the biblical prophecy about a biblical city that was supposed to be destroyed and then they got religious or became aware and that timeline didn't happen. The city wasn't destroyed. I mean, that's, to me, an example of some previous event where higher consciousness entered the picture and actually created a new timeline. Is it possible this is where technology, if used in a benevolent way, if we could hit something off of the past, if people are aware and learn their lessons so they don't have to go through it. I mean, I think that would be a viable use of it. But at the same time, if we know something's coming up, what moral responsibility do we have to step in and alter it? There's a lot of interesting points there, questions. And again, are there any other, we only have a few minutes left here, but are there any other events that you want to talk about or refer to besides 9/11 that you kind of only have a couple minutes here, but that you were aware of? That's in our historical thing, or anything in the future that you could say that, or maybe we're not at liberty to talk about that, of course.
Well, based on shop talk that I overheard where they were talking about some of the future events or data points that were in the intelligence files, I know they knew about the emergence of AIDS as an epidemic disease. That was discussed.
Right.
They knew about the advent, as I said, the advent of the World Wide Web. They had prior knowledge of the presidencies. I can confirm probably all of the presidencies from President Ford forward, but I have firsthand evidence that they knew about the presidencies of Presidents Carter, Bush, Clinton, Bush, and Obama, because, of course, after these technologies emerged in the 1970s, they could then identify who would be president, and they were approaching them and apprising them of their destinies, which may have been a good thing. I mean, the presidency is a mighty position to hold. President Truman said when he learned that Franklin Roosevelt had died and he would become president, he felt like the world had been placed on his shoulders, and that his feet were being pushed into the ground. That's how heavy the gravity of being president leader of the free world was. So I know that they knew of those presidencies. Two data points that I was informed of as a result of being a child on the project investigation by the project of my own personal destiny is, I know and was told that my discovery of life on Mars is going to ultimately be proved to a societal certainty with improvements in photoanalytic resolution of NASA's photographs from Mars, and I was also told that my truth campaign will succeed in the sense that teleportation will ultimately be socially adopted as the principal way of moving people between major cities.
Mm-hmm.
We'll replace commercial airliners for long-distance flights between major world capitals initially. So those two future events that relate to myself were shared with me by the intelligence community because I had been identified as somebody principally associated with the subject of life on Mars, and they also knew and began investigating in earnest when they learned that as one of the children on the project, I was going to become the principal whistleblower of what the project achieved. So I know that I will serve as the bridge historically between the advent of these technologies and what Project Pegasus achieved in the early 1970s, mm-hmm. and then the social betterment that will be worked when we do what we need to do, which is to implement teleportation.
Yeah. Well, I hate to end this, but we've come up to the end of our lollipop here, and I want to thank you, Andrew, for being my guest again, and I look forward to future times, other subjects that we can talk about relative things that you know. And so it's been wonderful. I think it's an incredible time we're living in. And I want to invite all the people there, too, that friends of yours, to definitely listen to this show today. Those of you who have a chance to listen to the archives, this is a really expanding bit of information when we realize there's been technologies available, been around, it's been suppressed, been sequestered. Now it's time to get it out in the open and use it in a benevolent way. Use it in a way for accountability purposes. So I want to thank all of you and again, I want to invite those of you who are connecting with the show for the first time, check out my website, channelforthemasters.com, prepareforthelandings.com, Vortex Network, or Vortex Sedona, toursofsedona.com. Now, Andy, before you leave, is there a website that people can check out and get more information?
Yeah, my websites are still under development.
Okay.
We're putting the findings of the Mars Anomaly Research Society at projectmars.net,
mm-hmm.
and I'm still building my website around my campaign related to the revelation of Project Pegasus and the teleportation capability that the U.S. government is in possession of, and that's at projectpegasus.net.
Okay, well, you have a wonderful day, and for all of you out there, as I always say, until next week, keep your eyes on the skies. Thank you.